Thank you very much. Okay, good morning, everyone. So we move on now to talk about our targeted standards level review of disclosures project. In the interests of maximizing the time we've got to hear from you, we're not going to talk through each and every slide, but briefly, and for the benefit of new members, this is a project that we discussed with CMAQ on several occasions during 2018, and the project stage that we are now at really involves the board exploring how to best use detailed and specific user disclosure objectives in the disclosure requirements of the standard. And a large part of the reason for doing that is because we believe it will better facilitate preparers being able to apply effective judgment about what to disclose and about materiality, where they have a clear understanding about how disclosures will be used. So in the materials for today's meeting, you will have seen that we have two topics to discuss. One is employee benefits and one is fair value measurement. Now, these two topics were selected on the basis of being useful test cases to facilitate the review that I just described. Based on feedback we've received, we also believe that these two standards will benefit individually from a review of their disclosure requirements. So over the last few months, we've been busy having lots of meetings with individual investors and with small groups of investors to discuss in quite a high level of detail the objectives that they have with regard to these two topics and the disclosure information that they get and the information that would ideally be used to meet those objectives. Now, that information was, like I say, received in a lot of detail, and the materials that we've prepared today summarise everything that we've heard. What we're really looking for from you today is your thoughts on the extent to which you agree with the feedback we've received and that is reported in the papers, anything that is particularly critical to you, anything you perhaps disagree with, and indeed if there's anything that you would add. For information, the next steps after this will be for us to broaden our outreach and talk to other types of stakeholder about this feedback. So, for example, talking to preparers about the potential costs of different things that they might end up disclosing. So the way we propose managing the session is to first talk about employee benefits and then move on and talk about fair value measurement. With regard to employee benefits, from our discussions with investors, the objectives that we heard are summarised on slide 15 of the pack, and the information that would ideally be used to meet those objectives that we've heard are on slides 16 and 17. Agenda paper 4A, which was the Word document, delves in a bit more detail into the information that's summarised on those slides, and it also provides a very high-level snapshot of the big picture messages that we heard. With regard to IAS 19, the pension standard disclosures, what we heard was really that for investors, the disclosures they get today often aren't effective in meeting all of their objectives, and many would like to see different information. So with that summary in mind, what we'd like to ask you to do is share your thoughts on the disclosure objectives and potential pieces of information that are within slides 15 to 17 of the pack.
I think this might be quite a difficult discussion because there's a lot of information requests, but let's see how we go. And,
do you want us just to vote on them all?
I mean, in terms of kind of the way that you want this feedback, I mean, is it...
So in the pack you will have seen, we suggested that if any members had comments to a level of detail that they felt couldn't be addressed within the meeting, we were happy to receive those, and to those members that have sent an email, we're very grateful. The reason we haven't summarised the emails is because I wouldn't say the specific points are identical across the board. The general consensus was, I would say, one of broad agreement with some particular suggestions. So the way that we'd really like to use this meeting is to ask you for your big picture. Do you agree overall with the position on the objectives, and are there any you'd highlight as particularly critical or that you disagree with?
So if I understand, if we're looking at slide 15, mm-hmm. This is where the kind of objectives are set out, and then on slide 15, item A, you're suggesting that to meet this obligation or this disclosure requirement, you'd look at slide 16, items 1, 6, 7, and 9?
That is the case. I mean, really, what we'd like to understand is does the objective represent your key objectives, and does the information then fulfil it effectively?
Okay. I would suggest that maybe the way forward on this is perhaps if we kind of focus on the objectives on slide 15, we have strong views, and I'm sure we will, on any particular one of those that's not being achieved, or actually is we don't see the point of that objective, maybe we focus on that. Would that work?
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
Mitch, you're willing to kick off?
Yeah, I'll take a first step. The binary, I found it difficult on this binary approach. Do you agree, yes or no? Mm-hmm. Ranking, I think, would have been helpful to say. You know, so that's kind of how I thought about it, which is, so for me, A, C, and H were very important objectives. I did over the weekend, so I can't remember why. But I was going to lay out. And then E and F, I didn't find, you know, others may have, to me, it wasn't sort of the most meaningful thing. And for me, it was sort of the trying to capture sort of economics reality, cash flow effect, balance sheet effect, to get to sort of the economic reality of the business. And so, and then on the info on slide 16, I have we'll wait till we get there.
Okay.
Thank you. Got Terence and then Deirdre. Terence, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think I spent a lot of time looking at pension disclosure, and I think for me, objectives A, B, and H the most crucial. And I think particularly B, when it comes to looking at the real valuation of pension obligations, when I think of about it from an EV perspective, the ideal disclosure would be a buyout valuation. I think it's the closest you get, it would be the closest comparable thing you could get across companies, and it's closest to what you want to use in EV, and anything else is kind of a proxy for that. I appreciate that there's obviously cost, et cetera, involved in obtaining that. Some companies do give it, most don't, but that would be the perfect number to get in terms of the disclosure. The other point is that also I appreciate better disclosure around the tax on the pension obligation. Not all companies give you the deferred tax assets related to the obligation, but I think that's obviously really important when determining your EV. And I think sometimes you end up using proxies to try to work out what the net tax the obligation net of tax is, which isn't always helpful. So having a specific disclosure on the tax side would be helpful. And then the other point then is on H, understanding the effect on the primary financial statements. I think there's varying degrees of quality of disclosure on this. You have some companies which very clearly lay out, you can reconcile it back to the income statement, to the cash flow statement, and then there's the other side of the spectrum where it's all jumbled up and it's very difficult to tie that back. So I think that's an easy win. But and then the last point I had was on contributions. I think, yeah, so point A, forecasting future pension obligations and kind of contributions, understanding that split between, normal contributions, one-offs, even where the one-offs are not necessarily part of an agreed deficit repair program. If it's just you've set out in your budget that you're going to make X above your normal contributions, it's helpful again when I think about it from like a free cash flow perspective as well, trying to work out kind of normalized cash contributions. And again, there's some companies are okay at disclosing that, others give you a lump number and you don't really have, you can't separate it out.
Can I talk you into letter C, just given what you've just said? just trying to build a little momentum.
Jaded poor guy.
Okay, so we're going to go to... I lost track of where... thank you. Deirdre, then Marietta, then Bertrand. Deirdre.
I would agree with all of the letters you've already mentioned. And I wouldn't disagree with any of the comments that have already been mentioned. I suppose it's an area that we spend a lot of time looking at as well across the sectors globally. And we found that, or we typically find, again, it depends on the sector. Sometimes the disclosure is quite good and you get a lot of this information already, but then there are obviously some instances where it becomes very weak. So we wouldn't like to lose any of the disclosure that's already there with regards to service cost, interest expense, contributions, when they're one-off, when they're expected to be normal. But I suppose the incremental piece of information, in addition to what has already been said, is we'd like to see maybe a bit more disclosure on multi-employer schemes, similar to what you see in GAAP, in US GAAP. And again, it obviously can be quite difficult to get that type of disclosure, but if we could get some sense of the materiality of that risk for the institution who's disclosing it, and also if we could get some disclosure around the mortality assumptions and the duration of the pension assets that the group are holding, that would be our incremental requests.
Thanks, Deirdre. Let's move on to Marietta.
Yeah, just one very brief comment on the defined benefit plans. I just want to make sure that if, God forbid, any defined benefit plans are still open, that they're also 100% covered by this. And I just found your wording very slightly awkward. So in G, you say, understand the risks of expected future cash flows associated with closed defined benefit pension plans. I think I would scrap the word closed here and actually put it into the next line. It says this includes understanding the time period over which any remaining obligations related to closed defined benefit pension plans are expected to wind down. I think that way it would just be a little bit clearer. I mean, to be fair, I think in a way it's implicit in E, where you're really talking about all of the risks, and I think a defined benefit pension plan is always a ticking time bomb. But I just think, you know, for the avoidance of doubt.
Thank you.
Bertrand.
Yes, I would say that not all analysts are experts in valuation or in retirement obligation. And therefore, I think it's we should keep the information understandable for these analysts. I would say it would be nice to understand the impact of such obligation on current and expected cash flow and P&L, where it is. And therefore, I would say that for me, the priority should be on the A, B, C, but keep it simple, I would say, and H, because this is important to forecast, you know, the future cash flow of the company, and this is part of the job.
Thanks, Bertrand. Salim?
Thank you. I agree with a lot of the points that were raised. I think when you look at the issue of pensions, you always have country rules as well, which is really critical. And, you know, this is most critical for the UK, which obviously has the most stringent pension funding rules. If you saw in the pensions regulator recently in their annual statement put out a statement saying that they're looking increasingly at companies which are not repairing their pension deficits, but continuing to pay out dividends. And given that we've had Carillion, we've had Interserve recently, this is kind of an issue of real focus. That's why I think on slide 16, that point six, which we just mentioned, is having those different values, those buyout values, you know, looking at pensions on a more technical provisions basis is going to provide a lot more insight to investors. You know, currently, if you just have the S19 value, okay, that's not a fair value accounting standard, right? It's a best estimate. So I think that's where, and I mean, this really came to forward Carillion, where you had so many different valuations of the pension, right? That's where you're going to get the most value, in my opinion. The only other thing to...
Sorry, sure. Celine, just that would argue for 7 as well, wouldn't it? Very strongly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Right, so we're getting more of an indication. What is the true cash contribution, what's the cash drain? And it comes down to the deficit repair, which Terence mentioned, okay, which is critical. Just on the income statement, we make a series of adjustments for pension accountings. You know, we only really treat the service cost as a relevant operating cost. But what we find is companies are not very transparent in terms of breaking out the individual components of the pension costs. You really have to dig for that. So greater clarity, disclosure around that would be helpful. But certainly I would strongly argue for 0.6 is something that can really bring this to floor. Because, I mean, pensions, it really matters when it matters. It's what we say to clients. So let's make it matter when it matters, right?
Salim, you touched on kind of the slide 16 points. If you were kind of saying the objectives in slide 15, it sounds like you've very much focused on A, C, and to some extent H as well.
Slide 15, this is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay.
Yep.
Jeremy?
So on the objectives, I think B is probably the meta objective in a way to, as Terran said, what would the pension obligation be if it were debt, depending on the EV? That's the main question. And therefore, the schedule of deficit repair and the tax implications are probably the most important things, items of disclosure. In terms of additional information, I think any agreements made between the pension trustees and the company, not always public, should be disclosed. So, for example, there's one company where there was an agreement if the company were to increase the dividend, for every pound or so extra in the dividend, they put a certain amount in the pension. And also any guarantees within the group would be interesting to know, because often the case, especially conglomerate kind of old industrial companies, it limits their strategic options as well if they're encumbered with a pension in one part and sell another part. So I think those are the, yeah, some fleshing out of any agreements would be helpful.
Could I just to, given that no one's got their cards up, the standout objectives that seem to be coming through there are A and H, I think have been mentioned by everyone that's specified, also so B and C getting a few mentions. One thing that is interesting relative to all of the feedback we've heard is that consistently we've heard about the importance of sensitivity. So I just wonder, given that, if anyone had any particular opinions on the relative criticalness, if that's a word, of sensitivity compared to the items you've already described.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
Actually, I was going to add, I agree with what's already been said, but I do agree that including the sensitivity is very important. Because if you know the sensitivity, or if you have the underlying assumptions with changes in interest rates and so on, I think that helps the user of financial statements understand what would happen in an obligation in the different scenarios. So I agree with that.
Terence.
Yeah, I think sensitivities are really important, particularly where you're wanting to put companies on an equal footing and compare. Because obviously there's a lot of subjectivity with discount rates and all the other assumptions, putting them on the same level and seeing how the deficits move is an exercise I would do, and having standardised for most companies that I look at, the sensitivities are pretty similar, but there is some which don't do it along the same lines. So having it in a set format, and also having it done in that sort of suggested table because of the non-linear effect, I think would be helpful as well.
Okay. Just on that sensitivities point, I wonder whether if you had the disclosure of the what you've got in line 6 on slide 16 with regard to the trustee valuation, the buyout value, you'd expect that they would obviously be different from the IAS 19 value, but they'd kind of inbuild some level of sensitivity to come to evaluation. Whether the sensitivity valuations would be as helpful if you had those other values in comparison to the IAS 19 value, I don't know. Become less important.
Sorry,
go ahead.
I'm not sure it becomes less important, because on slide 16, number 6, it's giving you evaluation based on those parameters. But I think in slide 15, you're just looking at how the pension obligation reacts or changes based on different discount rates and interest rate environments and so on. So I think they are different. Number 6 is addressed, number E or F on slide 15 is addressed insist on slide 16.
Just maybe a comment on sensitivity. I mean, I think it is quite important. I think the problem at the minute is the sensitivity analysis you get isn't particularly good, because if someone tells you what the change in the liability is, the DBO is for a change in interest rate, well, if there's a change in interest rate, it's also going to change your asset values as well. So you need to have them interlinked, not just say this is the effect on DBO if there's a 1% change in interest rate. It's not very helpful.
Glenn?
Mine is a question, really, which if you were a pension fund trustee and you were looking at the pension fund disclosure, surely one thing you'd want to know is not, you know, sensitivities are kind of interesting, but what you really want to know is what's the cost of buying this obligation out? That's a hard number. What would a third party pay to take? What would it cost to pay a third party to take this obligation off your hands? And that's the number you want to know about, because that tells you where you should put your debt covenants on the corporate. It's where do you want to limit the amount of debt that the corporate can take and affect the strategy? And if I were a pension fund trustee, which I'm not, that is the number I would be really interested in. And the sensitivities are kind of, you know, interesting because they're the scope that the company has for doing better than the buyout policy or worse than the buyout policy, but it's a corporate risk on a defined benefit plan. It's a corporate risk, not a pension fund risk, or shouldn't be a pension fund risk. So I would be really interested in seeing that number of what does it cost to buy out the obligation and make it hard at any given time to make it a firm number. And then I, as a pension fund trustee, if I were a pension fund trustee, I would then place debt covenants on the corporate around that, or I would give my approval for M&A or restructuring based on that hard number and not the sensitivities. Because sensitivities, what does an average pensioner make when you're told that your pension, you know, the thing could be X or Y depending on interest rates? I mean, what are you supposed to make of that?
How do you get that number?
Go to an insurance company, ask them to buy it out.
Yeah, but if you don't want to sell it to them, they're not going to do all the calculations, because we kind of discussed that in the meeting I had as well. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to get to the true number unless you really follow the negotiations to the end, and you can't do that every year and bullshit them.
I think you could get that number. I mean, I agree with you that might be, you know, people might want to do it, but the method for valuing it is kind of pretty standard.
Oh, okay.
It's costly, yeah. Of course, because it's it's risk-free long bond rates rather than equity rates. But still, it'd be an interesting exercise. I think if I were the trustee, that's the number I'd be interested in knowing about.
Okay, so time's against us, so we're going to go to Mitch, then Peter, and then
I was going to shift to page 16 because it seems we had drifted in that. Is that okay, or
yep.
Do you?
No, go ahead.
So, and that. What I, again, sort of preferred sort of gray scale, but I just chose 3, 4 as important. 7 is very important. And then 8, 9, and 10 as important. So pretty much everything in retrospect. Very discriminating over here. You know, 7 is very important. I just want to make that clear, okay? Yeah, that's all. Just since that's what you're asking for. There you go.
I don't have too much to say because I agree with most of the things that have been said. But since we're on page 16, I thought point 8 was important because we haven't really talked a lot about asset side. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always a bit challenging to put that in your calculations. Like if you start forecasting, there's really not that much to work with typically to start from.
Gary, did you want to say anything before we move on to fair value?
Yeah, I'll make it quick. I just want to respond to the gentleman down here. I was a pension trustee for about 15 years in former life. Several plans, domestic, international, probably $20 billion in pension assets in total. One, actually, I agree with you. It is possible to compute a settlement number, but I also tell you, we never asked that computed because it would be a lot of work. It's safe to say whatever the number is, it will be a bigger or more conservative number than in the financial statements. They'll de-risk it up and down the line. If you're assuming 10 years longevity post-retirement, they'll assume 15. you know, and they'll take 100 basis points off the discount rate or add to it, and I guess depending on your perspective. So I think it'd be done, but I'm not aware that it's routinely done by anybody, and certainly in my experience, not just my company, also net pension obligation was generally not thought of as debt for debt covenant purposes. It was tend to be the senior debt, the way the corporate treasurer would think of the parent's debt. So I'm just sharing that for what it's worth.
If you have to ask how much it costs, maybe you can't afford it.
Yeah, should we move on to fair value?
Yes. So moving on then to IFRS 13 and particularly fair value measurement disclosures. In much the same way as we just talked about, the objectives that we heard from all of our user outreach are summarised on slide 18, and then the particular items of information that we heard would best meet those objectives are on slides 19 and 20. Again, the Word document summarises a bit more detail, fleshing out the rationale behind those objectives and information suggestions. One thing that has been extremely interesting for us in this process is the contrast between the feedback we've received on the two standards, because whereas with IAS 19, what we heard was that in many cases users would prefer perhaps different information to effectively meet their objectives, so some of the things that have come through this morning about the importance of cash and for some buyout value, with IFRS 13, the overarching message was that the users we spoke to, for the most part, were broadly happy. And whilst they did have some suggestions, for example, around perhaps disclosures on level two, the key message really coming through was perhaps about application of materiality. So one of the things that is certainly in the staff's mind at this point, as we think through moving forward on this one, is about the value of fleshing out really clear and specific objectives, which one of the benefits of would be to help preparers in understanding how these disclosures are being used, and then when they are coming to make judgments about what is the most material in their fair value measurement disclosures and focusing on that, those objectives may be of benefit. So again, we feel like there is potential benefit to come out of this exercise in practical terms, and we are very, very keen on getting your views on the objectives on slide 18 particularly, and whether they are complete and reflective of your key objectives.
And again here, slide 18 and 19 and 20 are linked in the sense that 19 and 20 are the items that would support 18. And now I can't find it in the Word document, because it was a nice mapping table that you had for the pension one. Do you have the same mapping?
We do, yes. So that is in agenda paper 4A, and it's in the second part of the paper. So after pensions,
page 16.
We don't do the exact same.
So are you happy to kind of do it the same way in terms of kind of the objectives that people perhaps are most passionate about? So any comments from anyone on these? Go ahead.
Yeah. Just to return my credibility in selecting in a group, I've only chosen two instead of all five here. So D and E were important. And so I don't put the card up again. Sort of on slide 19, numbers 1, 6, and 8. Does that make sense? Is it there? Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead, Deirdre.
Again, speaking as a user and as a financial analyst, I can find often 50 pages dedicated to IFRS 13. Arguably, I will have read them the first time I've looked at the entity. I have to admit, the second time, I probably didn't. I saw in the Word document there was a comment about equity analysts saying they like the disclosure, but they don't really use it. I'm quite so far as saying I don't use it. I do look at level one, level two, level three assets. I am interested in the movement, and I can see there's the reconciliation there. I suppose for me as a user and any preparers who might be spending the afternoon listening to this discussion, my panic at my next sentence, but as a user, if I had a whiteboard, what would I like to get? I would like to get an idea as to, particularly for the level three assets in financial institutions. Obviously, there's a huge bunch of level two. But if we just say, okay, let's focus on level three, which is often where some of the issues have arisen, we would love to understand the amount of income those assets are generating and the capital that's trapped as with those assets, the duration of those assets. Like the liquidity isn't there because they wouldn't be level three assets if they were liquid. But that's a kind of a whiteboard situation, and I'm not sure that is a useful comment even to make here. What might also be useful for as a user would be maybe to understand a little bit more as to what are the key judgments that were made to enable the entity determine was it a level two or a level three, and if that key judgment. Again, I suppose the key thing here is that it's not put into another 50 pages because we won't find it. And the disclosure needs to be as neat as it can be. And then if that became the norm, we can then start to maybe compare between the institutions. But at the moment, we know they're black boxes. We know there's lots of assumptions used behind it. And I can't say if there was incremental disclosure that it would be any benefit to me personally. I'm not sure I have the bandwidth mentally to interpret the information they're giving me. But for us, as a financial user, financial analyst using this disclosure, it's capital, duration, income that's attached to this. And then what were the key determinants between the level two and the level three? And get rid of the other pages.
Well, if I could just ask, because that is really helpful feedback for us. You described that as your whiteboard view, yeah. Which is one of the very questions we were asking in our outreach meeting, because that's the exact information we're looking for. What's the ideal? Given what you've said, I'm really interested in whether if you could replace what you get today with your whiteboard list, would that be an improvement to you, or are you thinking the things you described would be useful in addition to what you see today?
I'm nearly, I can't believe I'm about to make the following statement. I'm hesitant to get rid of the information that's there, because I do know that back in, you know, 08, 09, we all spent a lot of time reading this information, looking for clues and hints and characteristics that might give us a bit more insight into what we could expect. Obviously, nobody did a particularly good job on that, we can tell 10 years later. But, you know, I'm hesitant to I suppose, realistically, before making a conclusion, I probably would need to go back and read another sample of IFRS 13 disclosures. But off the top of my head, I would say, you know, don't necessarily get rid of what's there. But if we could add in, again, it's always very simple from a user's perspective, a simple table, a couple of lines underneath. But the reality for a preparer, you know, is obviously very, very different and may not be achievable.
Maybe just a question, Deirdre, in terms of what you talked about, understanding level two versus level three. I mean, mm-hmm. as we know, kind of level two is by far the biggest bucket. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of reflect concerns that some stuff in level two perhaps is on the edge of level three, and that you'd like to know a bit more about?
Yeah, I think
that element of it.
It may be a question of comparability between institutions. Mm. So one institution might. Now I have no set example of this, so this is me using my imagination. But one institution might say that this instrument, I'm using the rate curve to determine its fair value. It has a duration of 30 years. Really, that's just too long. So I'm going to put it in as a level three asset. Whereas another institution might say, but I have the rate curve, I can infer a rate, so I'm going to treat it as a level two. And so it would just maybe improve the comparability between level two and level three, because at the moment, there, as far as I'm aware, there really isn't a lot of disclosure or transparency between institutions. And we do, judge institutions on this disclosure.
Thank you. James?
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of echoing what Deirdre's saying, but to me, the whole thing has been thrown up in the air since the beginning of 1Q 2018. So with IFRS 9 and everything else coming in, of changes that are coming in, this whole area of the of financial assets of fair value through profit and loss, compulsorily, non-compulsorily, financial value OCI, the disclosure just went nowhere for a while. I mean, we didn't understand what was going on in 1Q 2018. Some disclosed in 2Q of the half year results, and finally with the 4Q 2018, getting some ideas. But a very standard table that could be replicated without all the principles behind it in interims would be very important. And so that would be basically yes, or show equity, fixed income, derivatives, commodities, level one, level two, level three, just separate out what's FVOCI, and it doesn't matter if you lump in together FVTPL and trading, it doesn't matter to me that much. But the reason why is that, A, practically for me, we subscribe, like quite a lot of other people, to service owned by S&P that types all this in, they're just lost. I mean, I've been talking to them nonstop, and they've given up. They've thrown their hands up in the air. So if we could have some standardization, then we could see why I've always used it is sharp movements, what's going on, where are they taking a gamble, where are the financial institutions taking a gamble with this. So a standard table, I mean, the best one I've seen so far of the full annual reports that have come out as a sort of thing where you've got all of those is, well, probably not usually a great disclosure financial institution. I think BNP Paribas did one. If you could just repeat that in the quarters or half years, forget maybe, or at least just to see where there are sharp movements. We know things in intra-quarter move around and whatever, people hide things, but it's quite important because of the direction of the risk they're taking to see this. I'd like the same asset classes also in, well, doesn't matter, with amortized costs it's easy, no worries. That's really what if we could have that standard table just repeated, that can be repeatable at half years without all the blurb or the principles. Yes, keep the principles or these valuation to where they are now annually, but just that table we need. That's it.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up question? There's a concern about the volume. And do you have a sense, are there best practices out there or your own ideas that we could do something to help make the thing more concise? Because you said you didn't want to throw away. The question to Deirdre or anybody else who might have a sense.
I do think there's a difference between multiple pages of disclosure that are not directly comparable and multiple pages of disclosures that you can, period on period and also across banks, be able to compare and understand. So it's not just a question of having too much volume. If that volume is more than you might like, but it's actually in the same format and the same understandability across periods and across entities, I think that would be helpful. So it's not really directly answering your question about making it more concise, but one way to kind of circumvent that is just to make it more comparable. I think there's a difference between 10 pages of tabular disclosure and 5 pages of narrative. The latter is much more, I think, time consuming and maybe more difficult to understand.
I think that's a very good summary. Thank you, Islam.
Oh, sorry, the question was Steve and I interrupted.
No, that was perfect.
You're running out of time.
I'm going to talk about... No, I mean, it would be, again, using technology, maybe there's a hyperlink in the financial statements that could link to a point on the web page where all the disclosure is, so that you have the tables that everyone's talking about, and then not 30 pages of, you know, it takes a very long time to scrape that for the key information. So put the tables or summarize it in a way, of course, there's some narrative, but a hyperlink to the assumptions and the principles maybe that drive it. The risk there is that no one ever touches that hyperlink, except for, you know, when J.P. Morgan is bailing out Bear Stearns or something like that. But there is a risk that people would, that there is a risk that no one will look at until it's important. But,
people tend to skip it at the moment, though.
But they skip
it
anyway, right?
They're just skipping it anyway.
But and the point is that because it's so much, you skip that. Perfection is the enemy of good.
Yeah, but
I think it's right to remember that these disclosures really matter at a certain time in the cycle.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And
so
not get distracted by that. I think we have to always remind ourselves.
And you can't have variable reporting. I mean, the ideal circumstance would be to report the information that's relevant.
Yeah.
But how can you have a standard that says at this time you report that and at that time you report that? Basically, you end up reporting everything. And I think that's not a problem, really, as long as it can be audited. It's not a problem because the fact of the matter is you don't have to publish it in a printed format. It can be online. And if you think of the volume of material that's online, you have to mine it.
Yeah, let's drink from a cup, not a waterfall, in terms of information.
Okay, Catherine, anything you wanted to wrap up with?
I think we're happy. Thank you very much for your feedback. Okay.